Hello. Good to talk to you. We've reached the stage in which, having laid out the historical structure of an interpretive approach to the First Amendment, and having given some account of the history of the provision under conditions of 20th century broadcasting, that we're ready to sketch out quickly, I hope, or at least quickly enough to be rumored to be succinctly, an approach to what it means in particular for all government lawmaking, state and local as well as federal, to be subject to the requirement that it not abridge freedom of speech or of the press. In order to make that effort quick and maybe even succinct, it is important to recognize that we have now, in a sense, clausified ourselves. And I'm going to make an effort in the course of adumbrating this approach to indicate why it is appropriately limited, not in the sense of relating to the clausified doctrinal history which it inflects, but because such an approach to the First Amendment's non-abridgment provisions will also have consequences in other areas of society, which we might think of as assembly and petition, or which we might think of as part of the same structure of approaches to non-abridgment, which I'm going daringly to give an entire name to and to refer to it as informational democracy. Because, as we shall see, the commitments that we are left with when we try and understand what it means not to abridge freedom of speech or of the press in the environment of 21st century communications and the integration of the network of networks into every facet of daily life, whether we are using that nervous system to collect behavior or not, which is in turn one of the very most important subjects for government to be related to in non-abridging ways. When we consider the issues that arise and the categories with which we are likely to approach them as they arise in 21st century conditions, we are again and again confronted with the fact that the sentence that is the First Amendment is freighted in favor of democracy, whatever it is that it is also freighted with. We recognize that in doctrinal terms in talking about core political speech and the First Amendment, in which I think it can be recognized that there is at least an idea escaping clausification boundaries in which non-establishment, which is really what not with respect to establishment has turned into once one has federalized the provision, then state establishment of religion is as objectionable and, of course, much more frequently litigated than federal establishment. And once one has recognized that a prohibition on the free exercise of religion everywhere in the states by state government as well as by federal government has created a regime of universal toleration. And what it is that one ought to do about the ancillary consequences of universal toleration when it comes to extensions of or potential immunities from secular state law, because of course it cannot be that there are no such immunities or potential immunities, as it cannot be that they extend to every facet of civil life. And as one recognizes that in a world in which assembling peaceably is not only a matter of gathering in the street, because that is not the only way in which a crowd can inform itself and also inform others about the strength of its commitment, nor is it necessary in describing the relationship involved in petitioning government for redress of grievances to imagine only information flowing in a single direction under the impulsion of the population, but also principles that inform our approach to freedom of expression through our approach to the freedom to access public records, through the ultimate question: in a democracy in which information is power, how is access to information democratized? It will turn out that it is not only non-abridgment which reinforces this sense of the importance of informational democracy concepts to any approach to the First Amendment in the 21st century conditions of society. It will also become immediately apparent that the concept of democratization, the reduction in privilege and oligopoly and aristocracy and other socio-political constrictions of the ability to know, to teach, to learn, to argue, and to exercise influence, all of which are contained from an informational democracy point of view within the various ancien regimes, in which we can include, in addition to the Talbots and the Devereaux, also the Murdochs, we will find ourselves again and again recognizing, not in a clausified but in a full sentence form, the importance of the idea conveyed by the First Amendment in the 21st century with respect to the government's heavily structuring role in how information infrastructure is created, maintained, operated, priced, and otherwise used, which it must do within limits stringently concerning how it exercises content-based regulations of any sort, while at the same time providing for all the reasons why non-abridgment of the freedom of speech or of the press certainly means that government shall not unnecessarily or without compelling state interest engage in limiting, constraining, or reducing the amount of speaking that people can do and the forms of technological structure that they may use in order to disseminate their expressions, their emotions, their reporting, their understanding, their analyzing, and their objecting in social life. The First Amendment's primary time of vitality in our life so far is in the era of electronic broadcasting. The incorporation of the First Amendment in Gitlow and the post-1919 structure of the First Amendment dialogue between the courts and Congress and the states is ushered in at the same time as radio was ushered in to the lives of human beings around the world. In the era of the modern First Amendment, therefore, It was implicitly understood, though not necessarily fully accounted for in our theoretical understanding, that the most important new means of public communication, which then we called radio and television, the ones most vital to politics in all senses, were essentially structured by government licensing, much as the printed press had been in the bad old era before the Anglo-American lawyers evolved freedom of speech and of the press at the end of the 17th century, and in a mysterious process nobody could point to more than the statutory desuetude of there came to be in England and in its dominions. The impression that government could no longer license publication by rigidly controlling through a system of licensing what might be put through the press. And yet, as I say, faute de mieux, for technological reasons, in order to avoid a collapse of the commons in the electromagnetic spectrum through a cacophony of unlicensed broadcasting, the federal government directly controlled who could be in the business of using the most important tools of mass dissemination available in society, to which politics rapidly became absolutely dependent. It is also worth pointing out that the same moment between 1927 and 1929 is also the time of the birth of the concept of public relations, as defined by Sigmund Freud's nephew, Eddie Bernays, who created the modern industry of shaping public opinion for the purpose of affecting democratic decision-making, at the moment that the tools of radio became available for the shaping of public opinion through infrastructures absolutely determined by government through a system of licensing. In the 21st century, that system, evidently unconstitutionally, abridges the freedom of speech or of the press in a world in which there is no need to license, in this sense, the ability to provide packet-switched communication. Well, it may be said, but the wireless spectrum is being operated by license, which is how the oligopolists of wireless internet service in the United States are so well functioning that they can profitably provide wireless internet service to everybody everywhere all the time. To which it is appropriate to respond, they're being sold the spectrum now. It's pretty much exactly the way that the public streets were sold at the opening of the 20th century to the street traction oligopolists of America's largest cities. And the builders of the interurban railroads that the automobile companies dismantled and destroyed after the Second World War were financed by the provision of the public's property to private developers, which may be an appropriate use of the resources of the people. When scrupulously so demonstrated, that a law in the state of, say, Pennsylvania, prohibiting municipalities from having municipal broadband systems, on the other hand, That is, the use of the public's property to provide public services at the public expense to the public, when the state law prohibits that form of creating informational democracy in cities, surely we ought to be able to conclude immediately, since there is no issue of the legacy of private broadcasting standing behind our doing away with the licensing system for broadcasters tomorrow. We should do away with it tomorrow. Municipal broadband networks then begin to create a new relationship between the so-called public utilities, that is, the private oligopolists of bandwidth, who are indeed subject to rate regulation and may be, in theory, subject to merger regulation, but who are not subject to competition from the public, though they should be. The public option in the financing of healthcare, or the public option in the education of children, or, for that matter, a robust public housing segment of the use of the built environment, are all ideas with which we can certainly accept the importance of allowing municipal home rule and experimentation, not to mention competition. The course of the 20th century and its relationship to the mass media and the telephonic networks, which become the common wholesaler infrastructure of carriage for the packet switch networks of the 21st century, the 20th century's history put the federal government in the structuring of large-scale media, save print, which remained within a bubble of traditional understandings built up over time, absolutely hostile to licensing or content control by government, on the basis of historical experience and democratic theory, lying alongside a more important growing segment capable of sustaining large-scale systems of thinking and symbol creating for the purpose of controlling public relations, operated entirely by parties given licenses by government and accepting certain public service obligations in return. The way that politics interacted with those rules was fortunately more benign than it was in some other parts of the world, where it was fully demonstrated that there were new possibilities for the mobilization of force and the doing of harm, as well as for other purposes implicit in these new forms of communication. Whether in Italy or Germany between 1929 and 1945, or in Rwanda in 1995, it was repeatedly demonstrated that the power of mass mobilization and public information control made possible by radio alone, not to mention the lessons taught to us by television in the Balkans and in other parts of the world in the same time period, demonstrated at least that you could run an awful lot of genocide off the relationship between centralized executive power and the licensed tools of mass communications in oligopolized or state-controlled hands. Thus, we are in the world of the 21st century confronting the enormous benefit that we have learned from the 20th could be derived from using our networks the way they are technically designed to be used by peerage, by structures of non-hierarchical control and dissemination, and by the intrinsic ability to federate most, if not all, services in such a fashion as to assure privacy of listening, security of reading, as well as the ability to publish and thereby to meet whatever is the level of public demand for one's expressions, as easily as one can take a soapbox to the corner and stand up on it. This, the ability to provide smoothly for every citizen's expressions of any kind to be disseminated with the breadth demonstrated by the demand to hear or watch or listen to it, under circumstances which provide for listeners and readers not to be monitored by government or to have their behavior collected by anybody they have not agreed to allow to collect their behavior on regulated terms, this is instantly everywhere technically possible, given the already existing immense penetration throughout human society of the protocols of communication necessary for that purpose. Yes, it is true, we have financed other public activity by selling off the streets, or rather some of the streets, of all our cities throughout our electromagnetic spectrum to private parties to conduct proprietary packet carriage there. And that's fine. We have not, any more than the proprietors of the first of the bridges over the Charles, been guaranteed, as the Charles River Bridge proprietors seemed to feel that they had been guaranteed, that there would never be another bridge. Because it is, of course, the principle of informational democracy that there are an infinite number of bridges and they all go to all the places and everybody may make use of them at common carriage prices and on common carriage terms. We have the ability to provide a non-abridged system of informational democracy in society to replace that which the federal government directly built on the basis of the technical immediate necessity of doing so to prevent the catastrophic cacophony from developing in the electromagnetic spectrum and everything going to hell in a handbasket forthwith. On the basis of which some rather loaded political dice were cast in both senses, and everybody did just fine one way or another except the people whose informational democracy had to wait for circuit switching and the internet and all the public services and protocols that we have made and all the technologies we have created that allow everybody to do anything on computers that are no larger than the palm of your hand located anywhere. Under which circumstances we can afford for everybody to have a press and for everybody to reach everybody with everything, and we have the ability to create true privacy of reading amidst all of that system of unlimited personal communication. And the question is, if the Constitution doesn't commit us to doing that, surely it commits us to having the government order that there shall be less than that in the form of something else from which fewer people derive economic benefit and over which fewer people exercise more direct control. As we have already seen, it is equally easy to understand why, at the level of state regulation which prevailed in the 20th century, in which getting the telephone company not to be a monopoly and getting the pieces into which the telephone company was broken into being a competitive oligopoly was regarded as, well, not just the best, but more than the very best that anyone could do. And how wonderful it was that we succeeded in avoiding the situation in which one private company ran the entire telephone business of the United States, and you could only connect to it telephones manufactured by the subsidiary of the same entity. It is true that this, like the present-day structuring of the net in its not just last mile, but all the way halfway back up the pipes miles, has been the prerogative to regulate of state government, which has done the usual, let us be technical and call it, corrupt job. It is always easy to find a reason why you should sell all that the public owns into private hands so they can operate it better. In my long and, in this respect, mostly futile life, I have seen in many cities that were dear to me the selling of the public's property. In Amsterdam, the cables under the street, the entire municipal network of Amsterdam, which belonged to the people of the city, was sold off. In 1995, in my halting Dutch, and my colleagues at the University of Amsterdam, particularly the late Professor Rolf Studerheim, in their much better but no more polite Dutch, explained what a terrible idea this was. How foolish, at the eve of the millennium, from selling off Digital Amsterdam to make what was a beautiful little oligopoly known, as it happens, as Digital Amsterdam. But you see, the system of public relations and mass communications can do remarkable things, which is why informational democracy is so important, which is why it's good that the First Amendment guarantees it to us, if only we could get people to understand what it is that we're talking about, which I have now demonstrated to you over these weeks. It is excruciatingly difficult and perhaps impossible to do. But that doesn't mean the idea is wrong. What the idea at the state level therefore means is, while it is a low barrier to say that the state may not prohibit municipalities from attempting to create the infrastructure of informational democracy by actually having infrastructure again, that low bar should immediately be crossed, and then we should begin asking, how does the state government exercising its powers within the limits of non-abridgment go about the business of eliminating abridgments of the freedom of speech or of the press? Now, I will not argue that the First Amendment requires all of the items in the program of the .communist manifesto. I will not argue, regardless of the federalism of it, that with respect to the programs of the state governments, with respect to the program of the .communist manifesto, every single point should be implemented at any given place and time. But I will swear to the oath of belief on the basis of the analysis I have offered you that there is no reason to claim that any of the items in the program of the .communist manifesto violate the First Amendment. I recognize, too, that that's a low bar, but it is necessary to say that it is within the powers of the state governments acting within their borders and the powers of the federal government acting over the flow of interstate commerce between them, for example, to require that the public schools use open educational resources. The consequence of which is to advance not a clause about academic freedom, which does not exist, or the freedom to learn, which does not exist, but a freedom of the press, that is, to be able to take material used in public education and to copy it and distribute it to others in order to spread public education. And that power, notwithstanding the equally respected right of people to make copyrighted educational materials and to use them in whatever ways they can, but not in the public schools, without giving permission for others to copy, modify, and reuse that work as the public may with what the public has. That it is appropriate that broadcasting be replaced by systems that offer equivalent opportunities for people to accept advertising if they want to, while at the same time guaranteeing that they have everywhere they go, all the time, a free flow of information to and from them, sufficient to conduct all of the activities of daily life with equal dignity and respect. If somebody wants to say that there comes a point at which the use of the public network should therefore be prevented or at least charged for by people who want to walk down the street chatting with their aunt, I would say no. Everybody's aunt and everybody's niece should be in touch whenever they want to, without regard to the ability to pay or the whims of government, and their conversations should be private. And finding that in the sentence that is the First Amendment, as a positive command to government, we cannot do, but as a prohibition upon the abridgment of that right, if it is socially possible to achieve it, and if layers of government wish to act in order to facilitate such achievement, then the opposite cannot be the law. And then, of course, we do have the question whether in the public network we are talking about, we ought to impose some limitation on the ability to network based on the ability to pay, if what is going to be passing over the pipes is mere sewage from our enlightened point of view, whether that's the movies or the music or the pornography for which we have ourselves no taste, or with which we associate with those other people who aren't really, when you get right down to it, as productive and important as we are. In such situations, whatever may be the arguments of policy or principle that are offered, we should begin by asking whether there is any actual scarcity in society that we could not alleviate in such a way as to equalize everybody's ability to speak, to listen, to receive, to produce, and to disseminate. Is there any such barrier? We don't actually mean that everybody may use all the water without price in society, but we certainly expect that if people are compelled to purchase their drinking water in this society, they are compelled by public relations to buy their drinking water in little disposable plastic bottles, or to put it from paid hydration stations. We think that we have enough air and enough water to go around. And when I said in Berlin in 2003 that the principle of the party of the freedom of thought is free hardware, meaning hardware we can all understand and build from plans we can see, free software, which means all the software we need that can be copied and modified and shared and redistributed to do anything with our computers that we want to do, given to us by people who want to enable us and empower us to do it. And we need free bandwidth, which means the state's understanding of the equal right of the people to communicate and its use of its resources legal and material, which are dispositive, which will absolutely control how structures are made and whether they are built in the direction of equality or inequality. We must oblige the state to build in the direction of equality everywhere, all the time, with its resources, both legal and material, because the state is prohibited from abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, and that freedom belongs to the people equally. There are, of course, many applications of such an approach, not merely to particular matters of First Amendment doctrine or particular matters of freedom of speech doctrine or what we have been obliged but improperly to refer to hitherto for some decades now as press clause cases. But we can recognize that there will be common features from the technical layer as we use the nature of packet switching and the internet to recognize that we are all using the common piping and the common hydraulics all the time, that we are people who recognize that only in places where poverty pinches so stringently and political power has so far receded as to permit the selling of water as a unique, private, monopolistic system, that we are in no position to tolerate the prolonged privatization and use of individual firm control over routing to prevent a system of common carriage from being operated across all the piping of society. We don't need to forbid you to put a wire between two places and sell the right to move a signal over them. We don't have to abridge in one direction in order to operate the principle of non-abridgment in another. We merely need to assure that there is always a public, privacy-respecting line of information flow and communication serving the needs of the people in whatever daily life context they are in, and affording them the opportunity to express themselves in ways that will reach anybody who wants to read or see or hear them. We have, of course, further issues which at the state government level it will be well for the people in their legislatures to consider. How to save local news, for example. But we understand that the fundamental tilt in the direction of informational democracy will work itself out not only through the First Amendment or in cooperation with the substantial public protective doctrines of the First Amendment, guarantees of non-abridgment and of equality, but also in other areas altogether. We will have to understand to what extent the First Amendment requires us to refrain from some regulation of behavior collection. If it is our principle that the people have a right to establish information flows among themselves based on the ability to transmit to anybody who wants to receive, it is certainly possible, indeed it is mandatory, to make provision to allow people to sell their behavior in real time to people who want to collect their behavior in real time. It is constitutional to put time, place, and manner restrictions on the form of those transactions and to subject those businesses to regulation in interstate commerce, which they intrinsically are. But it is not possible to prohibit that form of technological patterning. It is simply possible to require that there be full disclosure about it, and it is necessary to require, and this is the one respect in which the architecture of the GDPR is consistent with, not inconsistent with, the U.S. First Amendment. It is certainly possible to require that everybody make choices with respect to the provision of their behavior data to collectors. Regulation over behavior collection occurs in forms in which, once the technology is fully understood by the people at large, through disclosure and through the publication of the material out of which that technology is made, that is a requirement that the software be freely licensed and freely available to study and understand, it is then the power of government to control how that information may further be licensed from the point of collection, what may be done with it, who may provide services over it, what inferences may be drawn from it, and with whom those inferences must be shared, and what businesses in interstate commerce can be built on it. All of this is regulation which it is feasible to undertake with respect to the business of behavior collection, not because the First Amendment provides an immunity of any kind, but because it does not abridge in ways which the First Amendment would prohibit with respect to informational flows in other contexts. Expression. We are, after all, already in the presence, sectorally, of government regulation over, for example, health information or educational records, in which the legal rules concerning the potentials for example, compulsory licensing have been constitutionally explored. At any rate, there, even under pre-21st century conditions, was no constitutional barrier seen in the Supreme Court or in the federal courts or in the literature, a reason for believing that it could not be so regulated. That doesn't mean those questions won't be open in the new world of the 21st century. They will hopefully be open indeed and subjected to the same dialogue that those potential applications have been, which I've already described to you. We are, of course, at this point in the sketch, compelled to recognize that it bears no relationship to where we appear at present contemporaneously in the United States to be going. Public dialogue about freedom of speech at the moment is not in a particularly elevated condition. And the relationship between the courts and the people with respect to an understanding of what may be done and the ability of Congress, or for that matter, the state legislatures, to take bold steps in the direction of what may be done is sorely limited. We are gathering, as we are with respect to the Fourth Amendment questions we previously tragically discussed, we are gathering a sense of where there may be new departures possible as individual Supreme Court justices and the other privileged voices of the legal profession begin to imagine the need for further development. I don't know what Larry Tribe himself would say, but I suspect that those who were interested in the idea, however fanciful, of the constitutional amendment for cyberspace, when Larry proposed it at the end of the 20th century, can now see why that would not be their preferred architectural structure. There's no cyberspace there. There's all of us here, and the question of our constitutional future demands scrutiny not from the point of view of those computers over there, because they aren't over there. They too are now us. And therefore, when we ask what it is that the dialogue of the First Amendment, the multi-party controversy of the First Amendment, the reshaping of the barely out of swaddling clothes 20th century First Amendment, so heavily dependent upon social structures now being reshaped decade by decade out of recognition. We would hope for a wide open, robust, and uninhibited public debate. We are now experiencing not just the onset of partisan triviality, however, but a narrowing of theoretic perspective, which is even more disturbing and simpler to explain. I wrote one time about the reality that the First Amendment, not only its speech provisions, but its religion provisions and its relationship to civil procedure in the federal courts, all seem to come down to the work of Hayden Carruth as the shadow Solicitor General for the Jehovah's Witnesses of the United States. The 1940s are the period in which the First Amendment and much other constitutional material was formed in what I called the constitutional rights controversies of the little man and the cop. And the cop, though of course engaged in all the forms of policing which we now recognize with such immense discomfort, the cop was often engaged in pushing around members of a religious minority, the Jehovah's Witnesses, whom Americans as a whole have come no longer to regard with suspicion, though indifferent incomprehension is a penalty of its own. The witnesses and their relationship to the police, also their relationship to constitutional democracy, oddly enough, imposed upon the courts an awful lot of controversies, the shape of which was the lone dissident and the police force. And whether this exits in Chaplinsky against New Hampshire or Jeanette against City of Douglas or whether it directly involves the saluting of the flag in the public schools, a remarkably a broad array of constitutional discussion is only had because the Jehovah's Witnesses exist, because the state mistreats them, and because they have a really good lawyer. In the 21st century, there are again an extraordinary number of issues which revolve around the person and her phone. And this focus on the person and the phone, like the door-to-door proselytizing or the soapbox standing or the police disliking of the forces of blue-uniformed government. Chaplinsky against New Hampshire is really about the proposition that if the you say Jehovah's Witnesses' lives matter and the cop runs you in, that's not a First Amendment violation. If Treblinski against New Hampshire didn't exist, then I think it is not only the case that we wouldn't have a fighting words doctrine and obscenity wouldn't lie outside the First Amendment and all the other baleful legal theoretical problems that follow from it. It's also the case that people in the street saying Black Lives Matter would not necessarily, perhaps not at all, be mistreated the way city after city after city they were mistreated in the summer of 2020, as the free American press is now more and more capably revealing. If we allow the First Amendment in the 21st century to come down to the person and his phone, we run the risk of the same underutilization of the real constitutional premises as we would like to run in broadening the Fourth Amendment to get some real work done. And here is the essence of the difference between tragedy and comedy. Where the Fourth Amendment constrains us to trivialize or deconstruct the real problems into smaller problems where, as it happens, the citizen fares poorly, and there is nothing very much that we can do about it, the First Amendment offers a plethora of possibilities so long as we are prepared to avoid trivializations, partisanations, and the belief that the primary difficulty is that free speech is being censored, canceled, or otherwise mistreated, rather than that equality is being prevented and oligopoly is being coddled. Yes, it is true that oligopoly isn't Facebook or Google. They are reached by the appropriate regulations of the advertising industry as an industry and the appropriate regulations of the behavior collection industry as an industry, which includes, of course, to some extent, expensive enforcement of competition law by the federal government. But the primary route to the improvement of competition is to recognize that in the area of information, competition is democracy itself. And that the principle of democratization is the principle in which competition, represented by this metaphor of the marketplace of ideas, but better represented by the metaphor of all the stories competing for attention and awareness and thoughtful deliberation in society all the time. A competition in which what prevails is those things which, for better or for worse, people want to think about, and the diversity of thinkers in society. This, the principle of equal access based not only on the ability to speak, but on the desire to be heard, in which it is the purpose of government so to order the informational structures of society so that the things people want to know are available to them. This implies a world of improved government dissemination of the people's information, as well as government's commitment so to structure the infrastructure that it builds and permits to be built, so as to ensure principles of equality are respected. We learned in the later part of the 20th century that government has a responsibility to treat its people equally, no matter whether their bodies work in the way that we assume is normal, or whether their bodies work in other highly normal, very ordinary ways. When we begin to understand government's responsibility to treat everybody equally, regardless of the nature of their phase in life with respect to optimal physical condition, we don't have to begin by asking of Congress whether it is constitutionally required to do that. We know that it is not. And yet we recognize the power of the Equal Protection Clause and the power of the First Amendment and the power of other constitutional promises made to the people as a whole to define a structure in which it is no longer thinkable not to adumbrate those rules and to put the public's weight behind them outside the immediate public sphere of public buildings and public accommodations and the information flow from the public to all citizens, regardless of the condition of their sight or their hearing or their physical mobility or anything else. Accepting the principle of equality within the First Amendment's non-abridgment provisions is consistent with the technology of the 21st century. And it is, if it is embraced by a politics of informational democracy, easy to make in law. Some of it is legislative in its nature. We can spend a little time next time talking about the particular forms of positive, effective legislation for the enactment of 21st century First Amendment values. But we can begin by recognizing the fundamental structures of constitutional interpretation with respect to that which state law and municipal law and federal law may not do, and what the alternatives now are to structures raised against constitutional principle on the compelling argument of technological necessity, which no longer compels assent. Forward to talking more about this and to beginning our last couple of weeks of, well, official school by talking about other aspects of the relationship between the state and the citizen in the period of networked government and networked behavior collection and the combination of the two next time. Talk to you soon.